of the life of Beth, comic interpreter of scripture, our foremother and scourge. And I will be explaining what that means, and it might not even need any explaining. Has anyone here ever studied the Canterbury Tales?
About 22 years
ago. Would you like a little background on what they are? Would that be helpful? Everybody can hear me, yes? Okay. All right. What I'm going to do here is try to kick off a series this week on how women interpret the Bible in literature. And I'm starting in kind of an odd angle to this because I'm starting with a fictional character who's the creation of a man's imagination. And so we're going to have to sort out some of the things in here that are valuable for women's interpretation and the things that are there because they're the creation of not only a male but a man who was going into a misogynist phase of his work in the later Middle Ages. The Canterbury Tales were written in the late, they belong to late 14th century English literature. And the setup, the idea of the Canterbury Tales is that there are these pilgrims going to Canterbury on a pilgrimage, and they each are responsible for telling a tale along the way, a little like going up to Holden Lake. And there are 24 people on this journey, and three of them are female. There's a nun, a prioress, and the wife of Beth. The rest are male, and most of those men are clerics. Well, each of them has a tale. There's a knight's tale, friar's tale, and so on. But the wife of Beth also has a very long prologue to her tale. And in fact, the prologue is longer than the tale. And there's some play on the word tale here, too, I think. The tale itself, we're not even going to talk about. It's about women's sovereignty. And it's told in a courtly love tradition. It's rather formal literature compared to the prologue, which is a rambling monologue, occasionally interrupted by people who get impatient, on the subject of marriage, or her marriages in particular. But I think the real subject of it, again, is woman's sovereignty. Now this prologue is so long that the friar who comments after she tells her whole prologue, he interrupts and said, "Well, that's a very long preamble to a tale." The pardoner, another of these characters on the way, declares it noble preaching, and that's the clue. This is really a kind of sermon, and she is a preacher. And there are many texts from the Bible in her prologue and from church tradition. But it is an outrageous, heretical sermon, and even the fact that she is preaching is heretical in terms of medieval theology. I don't know if you have studied this at all, but as I understand it, in the Middle Ages there are three states of life appropriate for a woman, and these are a hierarchy, of course. The most desirable state is the virginal life. And the second most desirable state is widowhood. Chaste widowhood, not marrying again. And the last, and definitely the least, is wifehood. And the wife of Bath is an emblematic kind of character because she is called the wife. And she kind of represents, in some ways, the state of wifehood. And Bath, as you probably know, is a famous watering place in England that's well known for its romantic intrigues. Widows go there to find new husbands and so on. So the fact that she's from the town of Bath is part of the joke about her. In medieval theology, part of the justification for this hierarchy, of course, this leaves out a lot of women, me for example, and many others. Justification for this is theologically, biblically that is the order of creation in Genesis 2. And the order of creation is a phrase that has a kind of technical meaning here. Order meaning Adam was created first and Eve second. There are other ways to read that word order. and many other ways to read Genesis 2. But out of that idea, that conception, medieval theology came up with a series of binary oppositions. You have the male, who's first, and the female, who's secondary. And the male was considered to be the essence of the human. The male sperm, according to Aristotelian biology, which was became influential at this point, said that, you know, the sperm contained little men, who, and when, you know, when they were conceived and grew up, they would be males. And occasionally you get an aberration of nature and you get a female, but basically the sperm is dedicated to male self-reproduction. So the male represents the essence of the human, and the female, the accident, or the deformation of the human. We're going to run across this idea of deformation again, because the wife of Beth is a grotesque character, and so her language is grotesque. And one of the most common ways of putting down a woman who speaks in public is to describe her as a grotesque, as a gargoyle. I've just been reading, you know, from my own research, reviews of Jane Eyre by hostile reviewers in the Victorian period in the 1850s and late 1840s. And they talk about her as a gargoyle, as a grotesque. You know, this writer is grotesque. Anyway, the other element here is that the male, then, if he represents the essence of the human, is created for intellectual knowledge. And the woman, guess what she's created for?
Having men.
Not one word for that. Yes, thank you. It's very good. She's created for procreation primarily. Now, they had to admit, they're having read Genesis 1, that, you know, everyone being created in the image of God, both male and female had what they called rational soul. So there may have been people who denied that women had a soul, but official medieval theology didn't necessarily deny that. Women had rational soul, but they had it in this inferior body, so that it affected their moral reasoning. So you have kind of rational soul minus there. Now, given these very basics of medieval theology, why would it be grotesque, heretical for women to preach? What would happen if she did, or what would be wrong with that, you think?
Well, she was causing a order or something that wasn't hers to do. She didn't mean the male side of the spectrum.
Okay.
And that wasn't her place.
She's upsetting the order.
Right.
Yeah, and usurping authority over men. Okay, that's one reason. Of course, this wife is preaching to a group of men primarily. So she's upsetting the order.
Of course, if you're an accident, nothing you say can be very valid anyway.
That's very good. And because you're not the essence of the human, intellectual knowledge is not your strong point, if you have any at all. So that a female preacher would be considered to be a promoter of public foolishness. And it's very appropriate to that misogynist view of women that the wife of Bath is a comic character. She is very foolish. She's so foolish, she's smart, in a way. But those are two of the reasons. And there is another one, and that is connected with the fear of women's voice that comes from the story of even the serpent and even Adam in the fall. That woman's voice is seductive. There were rules in convents in the Middle Ages that nuns couldn't sing, or at least couldn't sing loud enough so that the monks could hear them in the double monasteries, because their voices would be like the sirens. So a woman's voice is seductive, and I'm sure that there are women, I'm not a minister myself, but who have heard this type of argument about the female voice. And so the female preacher could seduce to lust. I mean, I remember arguments in the early 70s about whether or not women's ankles should show their robes and whether they should wear earrings and, you know, that sort of thing. So this is medieval, but it's also modern in some ways. Okay. Let's look at the description of her in the opening of this There is a copy of the poem right there. I only brought 15 of them, or maybe I brought fewer than that, because they look like they're online. This is the general prologue on the front pages, page 31, from Chaucer himself. His head honcho on the pilgrimage speaks these speeches to describe her. This is the middle of the page 31. A woman, a worthy woman, from beside Bath City, was with us, somewhat deaf, which was a pity. In making cloth, she showed so great a bent, she bettered those of ye present of Kent. In all the parish, not a dame dared stir toward the altar steps in front of her. And if indeed they did, so wroth was she as to be quite put out of charity. Her kerchiefs were of finely woven ground. I dared have sworn they weighed a good 10 pound, the ones she wore on Sunday on her head. Her hose were the finest scarlet red and gartered tight. Her shoes were soft and new. Bold was her face, handsome and red in hue. A worthy woman all her life. What's more, she'd had 5 husbands at the church door. Apart from other company in youth, no need just now to speak of that, forsooth. And she had thrice been to Jerusalem, seen many strange rivers and passed over them. She'd been to Rome and also to Boulogne, St. James of Compostela and Cologne, and she was skilled in wandering by the way. She had gap teeth, set widely, truth to say. Easy on an ambling horse she sat, well wimpled up, and on her head a hat as broad as is a buckler or a shield. She had a flowing mantle that concealed large hips, her heels spurred sharply under that. In company she liked to laugh and chat and knew the remedies for love's mischances, an art in which she knew the oldest dances. Mm-hmm. What kind of a person is the wife of Bath? What do you pick up here from this? Slightly euphemistic, but not very, fairly transparent speech. And she has some good, you know, pious appearances here, right? She wears a veil. She wears a kerchief. She covers her head on Sundays. That's appropriate. Anything else about her that looks good?
She was a worthy woman all her life.
Worthy woman all her life. Had her husbands at the church door, which means that, you know, the church sanctioned these marriages. Do you know why they married at the church door, by the way? Anybody hear this before? Apparently, you know, marriage was a sacrament, but you see, the wifehood is the third down on the list. Marriage was not very highly regarded. The best state of life in which you could serve God the best would be in one of these other states. And there was no glorification of wifehood and motherhood as there has been since the 19th century in Western culture. And so being married at the church door is sort of, well, the church is making marriage a sacrament and sanctifying the marriage, but not letting them in the church. And that has quite a bit to do with the fear of women's sexuality, which we'll talk about a little bit later. This woman has pious appearances, well wimpled up, broad hat. You probably have seen pictures of her. But she also has the red hose, gartered tight. The gap teeth, does that suggest anything to you? Oh, we've lost the code. She gives the clue to this. She's pretty transparent herself. It's pretty evident that she has venereal disease, and this is one of the symptoms of it. So she's been around. And there's a tension in this description between the head coverings that she wears, which are a pious gesture, and the red that she wears. And red in the Bible is the color of what? You know that answer to that one.
Adultery.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Scarlet woman idea. That comes from the Whore of Babylon in the Book of Revelation, especially that idea. So the red means to them what it also means to us.
But why does gap teeth mean? Yeah.
I don't think it's don't go around looking at people's teeth. And I mean, it's not quite fair. I always worry about this when I teach this poem. But yeah, I guess your teeth fall out. Does that make sense?
No.
Jan, you should know about this.
I should.
No? Well, anyway, there are other clues.
So it does not mean a gap between the teeth. It means tooth is gone.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's one of the things that happened.
Missing teeth. Yeah.
And she's a little mad, too. As we'll see.
Well, do you know this from other? I mean, do you know that
footnotes,
she has venereal disease?
Footnotes tell me these things.
But Chaucer was, he doesn't go around saying she's got some.
She says that, she says later something about the Venus's seal on her face. So I think maybe later I can find that reference in the poem. It's there. So she kind of confirms that. Yeah. Everything she says about herself plays into this interpretation.
Does it have anything to do with her being well-traveled, too?
Yes.
To Jerusalem.
That's right. She's been on these pilgrimages. Now, a wife could go on a pilgrimage without her husband, and she's evidently done that. But there were, you know, there were sort of rules about that in the rules of the game of medieval marriage. If a woman went on a pilgrimage, she'd have to take a vow of continence for the time of the pilgrimage. But she could never take such a vow without her husband's permission. Whereas he could go off on a pilgrimage any time without her permission. So even though, as we'll see in the poem later, there's the idea of conjugal rights that each has, which comes out of St. Paul, 1 Corinthians. The man has more rights than the woman has in that respect. She's gone off to these pilgrimages, and I'm just giving you the worst first here.
Well, it talks about how she had her five husbands, and then it says, apart from other company
yes.
and youth.
Right. They won't talk about that.
But she does, because she is, in one sense, she is an exuberant person who's enjoying remembering her youth. And she gets carried away with that in the poem. But I think the pilgrimages thing also refers to a movement, a reform movement of medieval piety called the Via Apostolica, in which people took a vow of poverty and became wandering preachers, like the apostles, like Jesus. And women flocked into this movement earlier in the Middle Ages. And the medieval reader would know about that. So these wandering women preachers, well, after a while, it became, the authorities became worried about these women on the loose, and then enclosed them in convents later on. And so she is a kind of wandering preacher, only she wanders in two senses of the word. There are a lot of puns in this thing. Wandering by the way. This is absolutely the worst, I think. She has some fair appearances, and she also uses biblical language partly as a front for other things she wants to say. But behind it is all kinds of vice. And that double female character looks very appealing, but behind it, look out, was a late medieval misogynist conception that turns up in sculpture and in literature in the figure of Frau Welt. Have any of you seen these in traveling in Europe? Where have you seen this, Frau Welt?
Cathedral portals.
Yes. In Germany?
Yeah.
This was, I guess, in around the same time that the Canterbury Tales were being written in England. Strasbourg Cathedral has a
yes.
Frau Welt.
I have one of your slides.
Representation. Do you? Oh, I wish we'd known this. You could have brought them along.
Oh, yes.
They're really disgusting, of course. There was an earlier figure in sculptures called Mundus, or the Prince of the World, and this was a male figure that had a very alluring appearance, turn him around or go around the back, and the figure is eaten away by worms and frogs and snakes and corrupted naked flesh. In other words, the creatures of death in the grave. And this is sort of a figure of the fair appearances of the world and what's behind those fair appearances. Well, it sort of transformed itself into a female figure at a time when misogyny was on the rise in thought and the culture, and also, ironically, at the same time that the cult of the Blessed Virgin was arising, those complete opposites. And the fact that a female is used for this figure suggests that it's a misogynist conception. Now, I think that, this is my own theory, that the wife of Bath is a comic Frau Welt kind of figure. And there are all sorts of ways she tries to allure, as you'll see, her male listeners. She's obviously looking for another husband, and that's why she's on this pilgrimage.
I'm sorry, but I don't have a good definition for misogynist.
Okay, that's a fair question. Misogyny is hatred of women, the association of women with evil, death, you know, the worst possible things in the world associated, and in life to come associated with women. So that, for example, a misogynist, it might be unfair, well let me make a comparison, it might be unfair that men have more freedom to go off on pilgrimages than women do. That's not necessarily misogynist. But to call a woman's sexual organs the gates to hell is misogynist. And those things are connected. It's a kind of spectrum, isn't it? I mean, they're not necessarily separate. All right. So we've got some kind of awful introduction here. And as we'll see, this Frau Welt figure, this wife of Bath, confirms the fears, the way she's written, the way she talks, confirms the fears of female preachers. She's a comic misogynist portrait of how not to do it, you know, what you don't want in female preaching. And the longer she talks, the farther she falls. We're going to look mainly at the front end of this speech. So that's where the negative part comes in. And she announces in her opening lines of her sermon a typical theme of misogynist sermons in the Middle Ages. She sounds like a Middle Ages preacher when she says she's going to preach on the subject line 4 that marriage is a misery and a woe. Marriage, in other words, in most conceptions of this to a woman. The prologue also includes several misogynist sermons, which we won't read, but you can read at your leisure and gasp if you like. She quotes other people, so there's a bunch of that. There's a lot of misogynist proverbs. I'll give you one example on page 286 if you want to look at it. In the middle of the page, she's quoting one of her husbands who's been going on a diatribe against her, and once you said that principally three misfortunes trouble east, west, and north. No man living could endure a fourth. This is in Proverbs 30. This is a Proverbs 30 and 31 has all kinds of bad stuff in them. But this is what it says in Proverbs 30, verse 21. Under three things the earth trembles, under the fourth it cannot bear up. A slave when he becomes a king, and a fool when he is filled with food, an unloved woman when she gets a husband, and a maid when she succeeds her mistress. Just quoting this. So there's other things like that in the Bible, this is just one example. Now, besides the fact that she is this misogynist portrait, and therefore a scourge of women preachers, because she's a scourge of men in this speech, she is also our foremother. Wife of Bath has a way of continually jumping off the page as a living character. She's not just a satiric butt, a comic butt of male humor. And I call her our ancestress because in many ways she anticipates feminist biblical interpretation down to the present time. There are a lot of characteristic things she does with the Bible that if you kind of eliminate the vice and the foolishness are strategies that women also use. And so besides the misogynist construction, we can also read this in part as a feminist figure, as a feminist Bible interpreter. That's the difficulty of reading this. You have to constantly be on the alert for the negative side of it. Let's look at the opening lines here. she begins to speak. If there were no authority on earth except experience, mine for what it's worth, and that's enough for me, all goes to show that marriage is a misery and a woe. Now, this is a very packed four lines. And one of the most significant things here is that in her first line, the word authority turns up. That one of the big problems for women preachers, prophets, reformers, I'm thinking of the Grimm K sisters and the abolitionist movement, for example, and others, is to establish their authority for their speech. Because the way that this tradition was reading the Bible, women had no authority at all for this kind of thing. She seems to say in this opening announcement of her theme that her experience confirms church doctrine, that marriage is a misery and a woe, and you only enter into it if you absolutely have to contain lust and have male children. But in fact, that's a sort of fair appearance in a way. But then she turns around, and it seems to me that what she's really asserting is the authority of her own experience. And in fact, that's what we get in most of this poem. We get her experiences of marriage, as opposed to what the church says about marriage. And she asserts, asserting the authority of experience, she's asserting the authority of women's experience against other authorities who would circumscribe what women can and should experience, and who would circumscribe how she should interpret her experience. So this woman is very boldly putting forth her experience and her interpretation of it. And one of the things we'll find in women's interpretation too is that they're involved in two kinds of interpretation. They're interpreting experience, social experience, differently from the way the mainstream culture expresses it, values it, and they're interpreting the Bible, and those two in relation to each other. She's not opposing the authority of the Bible in this for the most part. But she uses it. She goes back to the Bible in order to refute church authority on marriage and on sexuality. And we're going to find this too in a lot of women in the 19th and 20th centuries. Going back to the Bible is like making an end run around the church and tradition. And going to, you know, the source of God's word that can speak to you directly, particularly in Protestant women's interpretation. And then you don't have to deal with the church, with tradition, and with male mediaries for interpretation, such as priests and Bible interpreters. So let's see what she does with some of these texts. For let me say, if I may make so bold, my lords, since when I was but 12 years old, thanks be to God eternal forevermore, 5 husbands have I had at the church door. Yes, it's a fact that I have had so many, all worthy in their way, as good as any. Someone said recently, for my persuasion, now she's answering an argument of someone else, it's the first thing she does, that as Christ only went on one occasion to grace a wedding, in Cana of Galilee, he taught me by example there to see that it is wrong to marry more than once. Consider, too, how sharply for the nonce he spoke, rebuking the Samaritan beside the well, Christ Jesus, God and man, quote, thou hast had 5 men husband unto thee, and he that even now thou hast, said he, is not thy husband. Such the words that fell. And then she goes on to respond to this argument. What is this person, is this a good argument against her serial marriages? This, first of all, the Cana story, and then the Samaritan woman at the well. Why would she start with that, do you think? Is that relevant? The Cana, the fact that Jesus went to one wedding means you can only marry once? I mean, that's the logic. This is from a man who's of the epitome of intellectual knowledge. Why is she starting with that argument, do you think?
Wasn't she saying that that's what someone else has said to her?
Yeah. Yeah. Why does she pick that up, start with it, rather than keep putting forward some of her own ideas, I think? As a strategy, she's very strategic in the way she does this stuff. Kind of a straw man argument, isn't it? I mean, if you present your most foolish opponent, you know, then it makes you look very, very powerful in argument. That's a foolish argument. It does remind us that Jesus affirmed marriage which is sort of anti-church authority. You know, Jesus didn't put marriage down here at all. And then she goes on to quote the Samaritan argument. Well, does anybody remember the story of the Samaritan woman at the well? It's in the book of John, the Gospel of John. And Jesus does, in fact, confront this woman with her husband's. But the point of that story is not, go and sin no more. The point of that story is that she recognizes, and she has, they have a theological discussion at the well. You know this story. What's the point of it? I mean, what does it work toward?
Jesus discloses himself to her as the Messiah, and she becomes his proclaimer.
Yeah.
That's the point of the story.
Yeah. And many people are converted.
Yeah.
And he even uses a woman like this.
Yeah.
Not only was she a woman,
she's an act of compassion.
She was the least likely person to go out and believe.
Yeah. She's sort of doubly disadvantaged by gender and by ethnicity. And Jesus sort of, in effect, almost commissions her because he confirms this answer. It's a rather long story. You might want to look it up. It's very interesting.
And her lifestyle.
Yeah.
So maybe the strategy is to make what she's saying, like the fact, more believable by the fact that she too has sort of a sordid past, sort of this woman,
mm-hmm.
but she was chosen.
I think that's an implication. You know, that's
right
between the lines, and who knows what she's up to. You know, that might well be why she reminds her audience that there was this powerful outsider preacher in the Bible. She doesn't directly claim her, the Samaritan woman, as an authorization for her work, but many later people will do that. Men and women arguing for women preaching will point to the Samaritan woman at the well. And then people who argue point to the sordid past of the woman at the well.
But she's a good, I don't know, I like the way you read it, because I think the tone and the irony is as important as the words.
Mm-hmm.
And what it sounds like is that she's heard, she knows the Bible, she knows the New Testament, but she's picked out the law part to build her case, or how these stories have been presented to her. They have presented the gospel part of it.
Mm-hmm. And sort of implying that because the male interpretations of these stories are wrong or foolish, or they missed the point, they didn't read the scripture carefully enough, that therefore her interpretation will be a superior one. And she comes back then with her own arguments, and it's interesting that the male arguments she starts with are from the New Testament. She goes back to creation, and it's the move that person after person make, woman after woman make, in their setting up their own authority for their work, whether it's their writers, reformers, preachers, or whatever, is to go back to Genesis. And it's the first thing she sort of instinctively does. But what he meant thereby, I cannot tell. Why was her fifth? Explain it if you can. No lawful spouse to the Samaritan. How many might have had her then to wife? I've never heard an answer all my life to give at the number final definition. People may guess or frame a supposition, but I can say for certain it's no lie. God bade us all to wax and multiply. That kindly text I well can understand. Is not my husband under God's command to leave his father and mother and take me? No word of what the number was to be. Then why not marry two or even eight? And why speak evil of the married state? Just yet she's completely turned it around from saying marriage is a misery and a woe to the defense of marriage, and not only marriage but multiple marriages. When she quotes that Genesis 1 text, God bade us all to wax and multiply, what do you think she has in mind? She said that.
Well,
course, it's command to procreate. One of the ironies of this whole speech that's just implicit is that she's had five husbands. She's, you know, she's definitely over the hill, and yet she has no children, or she never mentions them. I mean, this is one of the primary purposes of marriage, was to have children and bring them up in the church. And she never does. And I think here we have an example of a kind of tricky use of church language as a euphemism for something very different, something not religious at all. Waxing and multiplying, I think, to her is a euphemism for sexual pleasure. She's using this general argument of the church that you should have children, but when, as you go on and read this, I think that's what she's more interested in, and power, rather than having children. If she does, she's gotten rid of them somewhere. When she quotes this other text, "Is not my husband under God's command to leave his father and mother, take me?" Well, that's there, isn't it, in the end of Genesis 2. And in that verse, Bible interpreters have read a kind of remnant of matriarchal culture, or at least matrilocal culture, for a man to leave his family and go to the wife's family is a movement that was happening in the ancient world, although more frequently in the Bible it's the other way around. In the patriarchal narratives, for example, except for the third Jacob story, the women joined the husband's families. So she's responding in maybe instinctively to the matrilocal context, cultural context for this verse, but she's completely leaving out the monogamous content. You know, that's the verse that people always point to when they're arguing for monogamy as opposed to polygamy or other forms. She completely leaves that out. So she's a very selective Bible reader. She wants to, you know, take from it what will serve her argument and leave the rest. Now that's not just typical of female Bible interpreters, as she's already made clear in her presentations of some others. Take wise King Solomon of long ago. Now she's going for models. And it's very interesting that, unlike many women, she does not refer to female models, except for that Samaritan woman who's implicitly a model. She chooses a number of bigamists and polygamists and men. So there's a lot of table turning in here when she uses male models for herself. Take wise King Solomon of long ago. We hear he had 1,000 wives or so, and would to God it were allowed to me to be refreshed, I have so much as he. He must have had a gift of God for wives, no one to match him in a world of lives. This noble king, one may as well admit, on the first night through many a merry fit, with each one of them he was so much alive. Blessed be God that I have wedded five, welcome the sixth, wherever he appears. There, she's doing something else too, which is ignoring other interpretations of King Solomon. I mean, there's a lot of criticism of that polygamy as leading him into idolatry on the part of the prophets. She completely ignores that. She also takes a literal reading of these polygamists. You know, she said, well, they had many, so I can have many. Just literal readings, avoiding the symbolical readings of King Solomon and of Abraham and their polygamy. I think it's St. Thomas Aquinas' reading of polygamy was that the patriarch could represent God or Christ, and the many wives represent the many souls that, you know, Christ brings into the church through the allurements of divine love. Now, this business of women preferring literal interpretations is in fact often the case for a whole variety of reasons. One of them is that symbolical readings ignore the facts of women's lives. She goes on with some other examples, and then she begins to use St. Paul. I can't keep continent for years and years. No sooner than one husband's dead and gone, some other Christian man shall take me on. For then, so says the apostle, I am free to wed a God's name where it pleases me. Wedding's no sin, so far as I can learn. better it is to marry than to burn. Now here she's quoting Paul directly, right? In 1 Corinthians 7. And this was one of the main arguments for marriage in the Middle Ages. You marry to avoid adultery. What she does with this text, however, is to piously repeat church doctrine, but she also, as it goes along, it's clear, makes marriage into an arena for the lust that marriage is supposed to help you to avoid. And so it kind of points out the hole in the argument of the church, I think. What do I care if people choose to see scandal in Lamech for his bigamy? Do you remember who he is, by the way? I had to look him up. Descendant of Cain? He's a murderer. A serial murderer, actually. And a polygamist. Not a good model. I know that Abraham was a holy man, and Jacob too, I speak as best I can. Yet each of them, we know, had several brides, like many another holy man besides. What's she referring to there, you think, in her contemporary audience, the holy men? She has other references to it later on. There was all kinds of hanky-panky that went on in these, you know, pre-Lutheran. It's pre-Lutheran. And there's references to friars sort of lurking along the roads, you know, assaulting young maidens. So I think that's what that's a priest. Kind of wink at her audience. Yeah. Uh-huh. Show me a time or text, she says, where God disparages or sets a prohibition upon marriages expressly. Let me have it. Literal interpretation. Show it me. And where did he command virginity? I know as well as you do, never doubt it, all the Apostle Paul has said about it. He said that as for precepts, he had none. One may advise a woman to be one. Advice is no commandment, in my view. He left it on our judgment what to do. Now, this is absolutely accurate. 1 Corinthians 7, verse 6. I say this by way of concession, not of command, he says. I wish you would all be like me. But each has his own special gift from God, one of one kind, one of another. And she quotes that passage, too, later on. It's a whole lot of 1 Corinthians 7 in her talk here.
It's interesting that she thinks Solomon's gift for many wives is also a gift for God.
That's right. There you go. The gift. She uses this idea of gifts and callings throughout this. Whereas it's pretty clear that, yeah, she may have a gift, but she also makes a choice. And this is what she prefers to do. This is the choice of desire. We'll go on with what she says about St. Paul. This is interesting to me because later feminists, the Victorian feminists that I've been studying, are very, very hard on Paul, and they have some tools of the new biblical criticism to use in critiquing Paul. They can say, well, you know, his context was different from ours, or he was speaking to a particular audience, a particular time. We don't need to pay attention to that, or we can revise what he says for our time. Charlotte Bronte has a passage in one of her novels where she boldly uses the tools of higher criticism to take away some of the absolute authority of the things Paul says on women. Well, of course, the wife of Bath, she's illiterate, and she certainly doesn't live in a later era. She doesn't have those tools. But she's also not terribly interested in putting down St. Paul because she can use him very cleverly for her own purposes. Had God commanded maidenhood to all, marriage would be condemned beyond recall. And certainly, if seed were never sown, however could virginity be grown? Paul did not dare pronounce, let matters rest. His master having given him no behest, there's a prize offered for virginity. Catch as catch can. Who's in for it? Let's see. Now, before she goes into this argument, her example of her intellectual knowledge, her logic, you'll notice that she takes Paul and judges him by Jesus. Someone in the 19th century I read the other day said, how dare we lift up the apostle higher than the master in these things about women. And of course, Jesus has very different treatments of women than Paul sometimes does in his epistles. And if you've studied this issue at all, you know that Paul contradicts himself constantly, that his work comes out of a number of cultures and traditions that are warring for the upper hand at different times in his letters. And what this wife does is to capitalize on some of those contradictions. And she'll quote Paul against Paul, as will later interpreters. She'll also quote Jesus against Paul when she can't do anything else, and can then also just be selective and quote the part of Paul that suits her purposes. It's not everyone that hears the call, she says. On whom God wills, he lets his power fall. The apostle was a virgin, well I know. Nevertheless, though all his writings show he wished that everyone were such as he, it's all mere counsel to virginity. And as for being married, he lets me do it out of indulgence. So there's nothing to it in marrying me, supposing my husband dead. There's nothing bigamous in such a bed. Though it were good, a man should never touch a woman, meaning here in bed and such, and dangerous to assemble fire and tow, what this illusion means, you all must know. He only says virginity is fresh, more perfect than the frailty of the flesh in married life, except when he and she prefer to live in married chastity. This was one of the alternatives to marriage that married people had in the Middle Ages. I don't know how many people practiced it.
St. Paul has it too.
Yeah, and Adam and Eve were supposedly had a chaste marriage, I think, in the beginning. I grant it you, I'll never say a word to crying maidenhood, although preferred to frequent marriage. I think here she's playing to her female audience a little bit. There are those who mean to live in their virginity as clean in body as in soul and never mate. I'll make no boast about my own estate. As in a noble household we are told, not every dish and vessel's made of gold. Some are of wood, yet earn their master's praise. God calls his folks to him in many ways. To each of them God gave his proper gift, some this, some that, and left them to make shift. Virginity is indeed a great perfection, and married continence for God's dilection. But Christ, again she's moving to Jesus here, who of perfection is the well, bade not that everyone should go and sell all that he had and give it to the poor. To follow in his footsteps, that is sure, he spoke to those that would look perfectly. And by your leave, my lords, that's not for me. I will bestow the flower of life, the honey, upon the acts and fruit of matrimony. Now, what do you think of this parallel she draws between Paul's teachings on virginity and Christ's teachings on poverty, which we hear so much about here at Holden? How does that serve her argument? And is that a valid parallel? Counsels, two counsels of perfection, she says. And of course, she's arguing for imperfection of her own variety. There's a whole lot of language coming up in the poem about money, and there's a kind of commercial metaphor for sexuality that develops, and that was common in the discourse of her time, and it's still common. And it's also there in the Bible. Let me go on a little bit, and we'll come back to some of this parallel, because there's more to it. She goes on the next page, about six lines down. Why else the proverb written down and set in books, a man must yield his wife her debt? This is also in 1 Corinthians 7. What means of paying her can he invent unless he use his silly instrument? And down below, Christ was a virgin fashioned as a man, and many of his saints since time began were ever perfect in their chastity. I'll have no quarrel with virginity. Let them be pure wheat loaves of maidenhead, and let us wives be known for barley bread. Yet Mark can tell that barley bread suffice. That's misquoted. It's the barley breads in John. to freshen many at the hand of Christ. In that estate to which God summoned me, I'll persevere, I'm not pernickety. In wifehood, I will use my instrument as freely as my maker me it sent. If I turn difficult, God give me sorrow. My husband, he shall have it even morrow, whenever he likes to come and pay his debt. I won't prevent him. I'll have a husband yet, who shall be both my debtor and my slave, and bear his tribulation to the grave upon his flesh as long as I'm his wife. For mine shall be the power all his life, over his proper body, and not he. Thus the apostle has taught it me, and bade our husbands they should love us well. There's a command on which I like to dwell. There's a whole lot in here. Maybe we could just sort of work on this the rest of the time and then kind of sum up. Do you know about this debt business in Paul? It's conjugal rights and it's mutuality. It's one of those places in 1 Corinthians where Paul talks about marriage as a relationship of mutuality and uses parallel phrasing, parallel ideas, both for the wife and for the husband, to suggest something that is mutual rather than hierarchical and you know, one being dominant over the other. So it's one of those passages that feminists and other people have used to argue for an egalitarian style of marriage. I'll read a couple of these verses here. The husband, Paul says, well, let's go back to the beginning. At the beginning of 1 Corinthians 7, he says, now concerning the matters about which you wrote, so he's writing this letter to the people at Corinth, it is well for a man not to touch a woman. Many people think that is a quote. Of course, these translations don't have quotation marks in them. It's a quote from their letters. And the idea that it is good for a man not to touch a woman was an idea of the Gnostics who were at Corinth. And Paul is having to deal with Gnostic arguments. Gnosticism was not just a sect, but a disposition, and a set of philosophical ideas among early Christianity. And one direction it took was to think that the world was irreparably evil, and the way to live well and religiously was to separate yourself from the world as much as possible. So one direction it went in was asceticism. And as Paul is, some people think, quoting this and then commenting on it and modifying it and giving a different view. That he didn't say this, though the wife of Beth, of course, thinks so. He goes on, but because of the temptation to immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. That parallel language. For the wife does not rule over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not rule over his own body, but the wife does. Now, what's the wife of Beth doing with that text? I will leave this to you to figure out. She quotes it very accurately. And anything else you notice in this that's biblical, in this part I just read?
She's saying that the act of sex is natural.
Yeah.
She's making an argument. In fact, it's abnormal if you wouldn't mm-hmm. want sex. You ought to have it frequently. Mm-hmm. As an expression of, I guess, a normal relationship between husband and wife.
Just not, not the official view of the time. Okay, and taking that, and that part of it is seems to be in more or less in line with what Paul's saying. think. But then she uses it, doesn't she, to promote her own cause. She doesn't quote the other half of it. The husband should yield the wife the debt, just like she quotes the positive to her half of the other verse. Husbands should love their wives. You know, that's the passage from Ephesians that starts out with wives submit to your husbands. She leaves that out. Husbands, love your wives. She said, there's a text on which I like to dwell. So selective quotation. Down at the bottom of page 280, I'll have my husband yet, who shall be both my debtor and my slave. She wants him to be her debtor. She's certainly not going to be his. So this is very much an argument for female sovereignty, I think, in marriage, not an argument for mutuality from Paul, or a feminist argument for an egalitarian marriage either. And bear his tribulation to the grave upon his flesh. Doesn't that echo Paul somewhere? You know, so she's even kind of becoming Paul, but this is the tribulation and she's going to inflict it. That's what those spurs were about in her costume. She is a scourge of men in this, outrageously so. A man's conception of what a scourge would talk like. There's a further trick and play on this parallel between virginity and poverty in here. Again, she's asserting her experience and its value to her. But there's sexual innuendo in this parallel. A nun takes a vow of poverty, sells her goods, literally. A nun also takes a vow of virginity, sells her bodily goods, her wares, as the wife of Bath says later. And all of this the wife of Bath rejects. She says later that her goods are for sale in marriage, and she isn't just interested in sex, however, she's interested in power and in aggrandizing herself financially. And so by linking virginity and poverty and then saying, well, to each her own, everyone has their gift, this is not for me, she sets it up for sexual marriage and riches for herself. And uses the language of the day, which connected the commercial world to the sexual world. In the King James Version, the verse reads something like, a man and a woman shall not defraud each other. So that commercial language is there in Paul as well. We need to stop in about 1 minute. Anybody want to comment on any of this or any other thing that they saw in this last passage? This is definitely not a religious poem. Now, we're going to do some religious poems and some other kinds of works that show us more responsible kinds of biblical interpretation, but also just how women respond to the Bible and reflect that in poetry. Tomorrow, I'm going to be talking about Emily Dickinson, whom I think is one of the most cryptic poets in the world, but she has some very interesting poems about religion and poems using the Bible. Christina Rossetti is another poet I hope to talk about, and Denise Levertov, and a black poet whose name is Lucille Clifton, you might be hearing more about if you come back. One of the things that comes out of this, I think, is that the wife of Bath knows that Bible interpretation is not objective. It's subjective. And women have been saying that for a very long time. The advent of new biblical criticism in the 19th century made it possible to make very solid scholarly arguments about that. But typically, feminist biblical interpreters claim and recognize that biblical interpretation is on behalf of, it's engaged on some party or another for some values, for some position. It supports some interests in society. And if the Bible is judged in relation to experience, as women will do, it may be subjected to a skeptical interpretation, in which case we have something I'll be talking about that is jargonly known as the hermeneutic.
hermeneutics of suspicion, in other words, stepping back and being somewhat suspicious of a Bible text or a tradition of interpretation, as she is of the interpretations of marriage. Or sometimes the subjectivity enters in a very opposite way, in that the Bible text confirms what the person in question most wants to hear said. That's a text on which I like to dwell. And that's the hermeneutics. It just refers to interpretation of desire. And we're going to look at suspicion and desire, especially in Emily Dickinson next time. So I hope you might come back.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You may indeed.
Well, thank you. Yes.